Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We're listening to excerpts from WNYC and the Apollo's annual MLK celebration. This next portion features a conversation about Dr. King as media strategist.
The Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr., president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, responds to the expulsion order and explains a new revised strategy.
Today, the superintendent of the city schools of Birmingham notified the principals of several schools, including high schools and elementary schools, that 1,081 students were to be expelled or suspended. This was a tragic move. This was an immoral move. This was an undemocratic move. This was an unwise move. We must keep our feet solid to the ground and know what we are doing and move in this situation properly. I want you to hear me. Now, we must study all of the ramifications of this thing and all of the implications. We know that there are certain forces in Birmingham today trying to sabotage this agreement that has been reached. They are trying to do everything to provoke the Negro community. They are trying to do everything they can to get state troopers to beat Negroes up and do all of these things. They are trying to do everything they can to precipitate violence and a riotous situation. And we must make it clear that they are trying this in vain, because we are not going to allow it to happen. We are going to think through every move we make. We're going to study everything with reference to these expulsions. Now, already, we have authorized our lawyers to look into the legal implications and to file a suit immediately against the superintendent and the Board of Education to get these students back into school. I reiterate, my friends, we are not taking this by sitting down on the wayside. We are going to do something about it. But we want to be sure that we are moving in the right direction. And we don't want to do anything that will cause Mr. Bull Connor to sit down in majestic delight because we made a mistaken move.
Joining Jamie Floyd on the Apollo Theater stage is educator, author, activist, and Amsterdam News journalist Herb Boyd. Pulitzer Prize winner and expert on the civil rights era, Taylor Branch. And returning activist, author, reporter, and cultural expert, Dorothy Butler Gilliam.
It's an honor to be with you all. We want to say a special thank you to the Riverside Church Archives for the 1963 audio recordings of Dr. King that you just heard, recently restored to that pristine sound of Dr. King's resonant voice. And let's start there. We just heard Taylor Branch, that contemplative yet emotional moment at the pulpit, Dr. King strategizing about the children in Birmingham, 1,000 children suspended or expelled for protesting for their civil rights in Birmingham. What was the importance and Dr. King's strategic approach to using children in the movement at that moment in Birmingham, especially as he had an eye toward the media?
Well, this was the biggest gamble of his career. Everybody, most people on the staff and all the black parents in Birmingham were against it and didn't want to do that. I mean, we've got six, we have to remember it's 6, 8, 10, 12-year-olds marching into those dogs and fire hoses. I mean, we have some downstairs in the green room and they're cute and everybody's talking about our books and everything, but it's the little kids that did this and broke the emotional back. That was a tremendous angst-filled decision. And people said things like, if they're old enough to decide to be baptized and determine their eternal destiny, they're old enough to march into these dogs and fire hoses. That's easy to say when you know it's going to work, but when you know it's not going, you don't know that, it was very difficult. Everybody was against it. Bobby Kennedy was against it. Malcolm X was against it. You know, how can you send children out to do your battle? So I think one of the things we have to understand about strategy is that if you're not unsettled about strategy, then you're not going anywhere. The movement was constantly unsettled and at each other's throats about what to do. And Dr. King had to go against all the black parents of Birmingham saying, you came here promising to give us freedom. We've been in jail. You're about to leave town, and now you want to leave our children with criminal records.
And he was dealing with a very different person in Bull Connor than he had been in Albany, right? In Albany, Georgia. Give us a little bit of a historical contextual lesson there.
Bull Connor wanted the tallest policeman with the biggest boots and the loudest motorcycles to scare people to death, and he was happy with the rumors about what was going on in those jails. And the only people willing to march were kids. And most of them marched against the will of their parents.
Now, a lot of the strategy had to do with the Northern Press, what we now call the legacy media, right? But let's talk, Herb Boyd, about the black press, the importance of the black press at the time. Explain to us the vibrancy of it and the ways in which Dr. King's movement, the movement, our movement, intersected with the black press of the 1960s.
Well, it's an accumulative process. You have to put it in perspective.
Please.
One of the things with historically, the black press has always stepped up to a cause. I mean, you go back to the first Freedom's Journal, 1827, March in Brooklyn, you know, with the Samuel Cornish and John Russworm. They put out the motto of that paper, the masthead said, we wish to plead our own cause. In other words, for so long, people have spoken for us, a lot of misinformation, misinterpretations. It's time for us to speak for ourselves. That was the beginning, more or less, of black journalism. Of course, they were hardly an enemy of the people, you know. So one of the things about the black press being like an agent for our liberation in this country, they was there. Fast forward that across Frederick Douglass, Martin Delaney, T. Thomas Fortune, all the way down to, as you were speaking, Dorothy, earlier about Emmett Till. That's a critical run-up to the involvement of the black press, you know, in the movement, because when you look at what happened with Emmett Till down in Mississippi, I remember reading Jimmy Hicks and the Cleveland Post and Call. If any one individual of the press was absolutely indispensable in giving us information from a black perspective, because he had to deal with a lot of right reactionary white publications in the South who had a different opinion. The Chicago Defender, you remember, like Maddie Smith, Colin, you know, she was down there. So we had black press who was reporting on that. Because that's an interesting run-up to the civil rights movement, because when you talk about Rosa Parks, when she was on that bus, and she said the one thing that was on her mind was Emmett Till. So here you have that connection then of the black press down there, you know, Jimmy Hicks, you know, he's covering it, and he would morph right on into, when he take over at the Amsterdam News, he began to send his reporters down there, along with the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier. All of these papers were very, very, very much involved in the movement at that time. And so when you look at the, like a Jimmy Hicks reporting on that, right here in New York City for the Amsterdam News, and all of the other individuals who are connected to that, that's the source of it. That's the kind of like the beginning, the vortex, in terms of the black press continuing a tradition that had been a part of it all the way back to 1827. So it was nothing new about the black press being ready to go to battle.
When I think of you, Dorothy Gilliam, stepping into the footsteps of Ida B. Wells, but then going down and covering this movement, you talked about, with Allison, you talked about your motivation, but you didn't speak of the danger. Can you speak about just the reality on the ground a bit more? What it was like facing down, maybe your fear, maybe you were fearless, maybe both.
When I had been at the Washington Post 1 year, and I'd like to preface that by saying I worked in the black press for almost 5 years before I went to the Washington Post, and that helped me in so many ways in my work at the Post. But I was sent to go to Mississippi and cover the integration, not on the campus, because I would have been dead meat trying to cover that. But I was sent right after Meredith had finally been, had finally enrolled after, on the fifth try, and it took over 32,000 troops to actually get him in and to keep him in there. But my job was to go down and really look at what was happening in terms of the black community. Now, this was a time when white reporters were not going into the black community to say, you know, how do you feel about all of this?
And this is James Meredith, who not only did they have to send the troops, but this is after litigation,
exactly.
Litigation.
Absolutely.
So it was a major national story, but
absolutely,
of course, a huge contextual story for the civil rights movement down south.
Absolutely.
So you went down to cover this.
Yes, so I went down to cover that. To cover that aspect of it. What did the black community think of this? And I was so glad to do that, because so often in the white press, there would always be kind of stereotypical representations of black people. And in fact, some people said that during the anarchy on the campus that happened as a result of James Meredith finally enrolling, they said the black people ran up into the hills just because they were so frightened. But I didn't find that. I went out and I found people who were so thrilled at what James Meredith had done, who were not running up into the hills, but they were saying even more progress is going to be made. The progress that he has started, we will pick up on that progress. And to me, was very important, just to begin to get beyond those views that the larger public had about African Americans. But as a black reporter going into Oxford, I had to think about things like, where was I going to sleep, because there were no hotels for black people. And I ended up staying in a black funeral home because there was no hotel. And I'm glad I had a place to stay. Nobody bothered me. But the point is that, as Herb was talking about, even with the black press, you had to deal with all the laws of segregation that the local people also dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, just getting to Oxford, there were dangers. I was riding with this black photographer that I had hired, a freelance photographer, and we were stopped on the road from Memphis into Oxford. And they were not lawmen or anything. They just saw us going and waved us down. And we stopped because that was the, you know, white people could tell people, black people, what to do, and they would do it. And but they said, well, where are you going? And so my photographer was able to talk us out of that and to make him believe that we really weren't going to Oxford. But the difficulties of covering those stories that black reporters, especially for the black press, before the white press even started seriously looking at it, those were really, I think, very challenging times. And I remember when I worked at Jet Magazine for a couple of years, and people like Francis Mitchell and Alex Poinsett and Mark Crawford, I mean, they'd have to put a Bible under their arm and pretend they were preachers because they didn't want the sheriffs to know that they were down there writing stories that was basically lifting that cotton curtain, letting the rest of the world know what was really happening. Mm. And many times they'd have to hide their old-fashioned portable typewriters. They would wrap them up in old cloth and old newspapers to try to make it appear that they were just ambling down the street mm-hmm. when they were really mm-hmm. writing stories about what was going on. So it's been a long period of our community, our journalists, as you said, since 1827. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, now we have a time when the press is still very crucial, but mm-hmm. it was strategically. And Taylor, you may have some other thoughts about, you know, how strategically Dr. King used the media. It was crucial.
And I was going to say press is still under siege. I was going to follow up with that. But yes. I want to ask the question Dorothy is asking you, to all three of you, as we close. And, of course, that clock is looking at us. But I ignore it, as always. The question is, you know, Dr. King, and this is the follow-on, being a journalist, we're doing our journalism together. So Dr. King is, of course, long thought of as a great thinker, a great speaker, a great leader, a scholar. But is it fair to say he was a great producer of events? I'll ask each of you to briefly answer that question.
I think one of them, in one case in particular, he was. He watched Birmingham and Meredith. He actually had been hit by a Nazi at his convention in Birmingham and was laid up in bed. And he said, at the end, he said, if it takes 30,000 soldiers to get one black man into the University of Mississippi, our movement might be losing its window in history. That was his motivation to go into Birmingham, to take the strategic risk. We have to do, it was the first time he really designed a whole movement and went in there and risked everything. And ultimately, it was only because of the kids at the very end that they was rescued. So that was strategic. I think his message, the easiest thing to say about his message and what made him unique is the way he framed things. He would always put one foot in the Constitution and one foot in the Scripture mm-hmm. and say, equal souls, equal votes, we're going. But in the case of Birmingham, he said, the greatest principles of democracy are not enough sometimes. You have to sacrifice. You have to amplify it with witness. And so he designed a witness in Birmingham.
Right, because Herb Boyd, he wanted to make sure that there were enough eyeballs, cameras, photographers, print reporters witnessing that moment to get the message out beyond either Birmingham or Selma or wherever that action was happening, right?
They had the names of all the reporters on their Rolodexes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they knew where they lived, and they would call them and say, cover this story. And they didn't take the failure of getting it in the press today as the end-all and be-all. They wanted to try to do it tomorrow, and they'd meet all night about how to do that.
So, Herb, is it fair to Mr. Boyd? Fair to call him a producer? Fair?
Oh, no doubt about it. He was an orchestrator. He was an improviser. He was a strategist. He was like a conductor. He was a journalist, too. Hmm. He understood the kind of drama of that moment and how to intensify it. He knew that if this movement was going to have any kind of resonance, you know, for the globe, we're going to have some drama here. So he had a way of almost being a provocateur. you know, in needling the press and making sure the press, you know, was guided in the right way.
I'm going to say a very special thank you to Herb Boyd, yes, Taylor Branch, and Dorothy Butler Gilliam for their insights on Dr. King's strategic use of media to forward the civil rights movement.
I'm Allison Stewart, and you're listening to All of It. We'll continue with more from WNYC and the Apollos, The Strategic King, MLK's Visionary Leadership.